welcome to the Next Level Podcast. It's Tim Miller in the host chair. God damn it. I got to keep hosting again because JVL is out this week. I'm here with my best friend from the mid-aughts, Sarah Longwell, and an aspiring new friend and mentee, Andrew Egger.
I don't think you can identify somebody as your mentee. I think they have to tap you as mentor.
Oh, that's how that works? Okay.
I do think
so. Okay, whatever. I've got a wide range of people that I aspire to want to be my mentee, but maybe not all of them will you know, kind of fit that requirement. Andrew, how you doing?
I'm great.
Nice hat.
Oh, thank you.
I said you were worried about your look for YouTube, and I think you look nice.
Well, that's so nice of you to say. I think it came together okay myself.
Okay. JVL is on spring break. I'm also on spring break, which is not a break. I have four children in my home. My nephews and nieces are here. And so if you hear random yelps during the podcast, that is just me enjoying a beach holiday. Sarah, I'm over the Republican primary. I'm done with it. I've been done with it for like a month. I can't bring myself to care. And yet we have people like you who are still, and Bill Kristol, who are still analyzing the county by county numbers, looking for that diamond in the rough, looking for that little bit of proof that Joe Biden might really win after all. And so I'd like to hear your analysis of what happened in Wisconsin last night.
This is not about the primary. This is about the general election. This is about identifying the voters who don't want to vote for Donald Trump and could be potentially gettable for Joe Biden. And last night, just like when the Arizona primary, it sort of came out of nowhere that almost 20%, I think it was 18% of Republicans in Arizona came out to vote against Donald Trump at a time when the alternatives weren't even technically on the ballot. They were there to vote for, but they have already dropped out of this race. And so last night in Wisconsin, to see 70,000 Republicans, I think it was ultimately 72,000 by this morning, vote against Donald Trump, vote for Nikki Haley specifically. And then you drop on top of that.
Don't forget Ron DeSantis.
Well, I was going to say, he got 3%. Yeah, he got a little over 3%. And then there was, what's the one that they can check that it's like uncommitted, I think is the...
They called it uninstructed, which is very British.
Uninstructed, yeah, it was a weird name. Weird name, but... All that, if you add up Ronnie D, you add up Nikki, and you add up the unrequited or whatever, you get 100%, you get like 100,000 voters who last night in the Wisconsin Republican primary said no to Trump. He didn't even crack 80%. That's meaningful. Now look, and here's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, Joe Biden, this story is there for Joe Biden too, right? There's a story about people, especially in Michigan, you saw the uncommitted turn out to send a message, right? Protest voting. And so these are essentially message sending deals whenever you see these numbers like this, right? Because nobody thinks Nikki Haley's actually going to win. And the uncommitted, thing in Michigan is just to scare Joe Biden into doing, you know, what Rashida Tlaib wants and actually and what a lot of progressive voters want. But the thing, I think that there is more likely, it is more likely those progressives who are mad about Gaza, they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. Like,
they whereas might vote for Jill Stein.
They might vote for Jill Stein. Chicken. It's true. But the Nikki Haley voters could vote for Joe Biden, a percentage of them.
Sure. Some of them probably did. Many of them probably did.
Right. Well, for sure, many of them did. There's no doubt that in that number, and I think people, you can really overread the Nikki Haley numbers because if you don't understand that a bunch of those people have been voting for Democrats, even though they're right-leaning independents and soft GOP voters, you're overtelling the story. But, you know, Wisconsin went for Biden by 20,000 votes. So in terms of holding the anti-Trump coalition together, I do read, it's certainly not bad news. I'm not saying it's everything, but I think it's still worth looking at. And it's very much worth being able to identify for me, right? Because I am in addition to the podcasting business, in addition to the peeling Republican-ish voters off of Trump, that to me is it's a lot to work with.
Speaking of which, I want Edgar's take on this, but before we get to that, I wanted to also acknowledge your other co-host on your other podcast, Cheated on Me, with George Conway. News story out today that he gave the maximum donation, almost $1 million, to Joe Biden. So you got in that podcast, George Conway explains it all to Sarah Longwell. There's a lot of activism associated with that podcast, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, but neither George Conway nor I, and despite us being very different people, neither of us want Donald Trump to be the president again in a deep, deep way. And
I appreciate and your commitment to that cause.
Yeah, thank you.
Wisconsin, one other thing I just want to mention, Sarah. We took that, remember we took that mailbag question on the board podcast from the person thinking of moving to Door County? I don't know if she moved or not, but huge turnout for Nikki, 13.5% in Door County. Big numbers. The unrequited 3%. Egger, do you share Sarah's optimism? I'm not sure that I do. So, you know, you feel free to tell her that this
you don't have to give him permission to disagree with me. He can do it on his own.
No,
he's a big boy. He's a big boy. He can have his own opinions.
So I don't know. I don't know the best way to gloss all this. I do think it's important that, you know, there's a specific political aim for like the, yeah, now you got unrequited in my mind. I don't even remember what the actual word was. The
uninstructed
vote. I mean, they're trying to accomplish a particular political purpose with that vote right now, which is not necessarily incompatible with them going back and voting for Biden in November. Whereas there really isn't any kind of like organized drive on the Republican side to do anything other than kind of wait for Donald Trump to lock up this nomination. And I do think when you see these people still showing up and still pulling the lever for Haley, it's not even really that. I mean, yes, I mean, we talk about like the crossover vote from Democrats and things like that. And that was an important part of a lot of the early primaries. There was actually kind of like we talked about that primary pivot group where there was an actual organized effort to get Republicans to come out and boost Nikki Haley. But I mean, that's no longer happening. There's no real purpose to any of that anymore. It's just voters kind of showing up in their genuine feelings and casting a ballot for somebody other than Trump. And that's the thing that's going to be sticky into November. I mean, who knows what the geopolitical situation with the war in Gaza is going to look like by the time the election actually rolls around. Biden has already, you know, pulled back significantly from his kind of early, very staunchly pro Netanyahu government kind of allyship there. So, you know, it does seem to me that you know, one of these problems on Biden's side could be shrinking. Who knows what that will end up looking like by November, whereas the other is more just kind of this baseline dissatisfaction on the Republican side with these people still showing up for Haley.
We are going to get to Gaza. If you're just buckle up, folks.
Wait, can I just say one last thing on this, which is about enthusiasm?
Can I give you my negative point and then you can do the positive? Sure. Here's why. I'm negative on this. I've just been sitting here scrolling county to county, you know, Adams. We're in rural, Taylor, Rusk. Nikki Haley's at 7, 3, 4. Madison, 24%. Almost a quarter of the vote in Madison. I don't think that those people were Donald Trump voters. I just don't. I don't know that there's any evidence that these 6,642 people that we're adding to Joe Biden's narrow victory in Wisconsin last time. And so I just don't know how excited I'm supposed to get about people that I think largely probably were not Donald Trump voters.
Oh, well, let me tell you.
Time.
Can I tell you why you should be excited?
Please. I would love to be excited.
Okay. The reason is that Joe Biden won Wisconsin last time. He has to hold that coalition together. He won it last time.
Donald Trump claims that he lied about it. I do like to, you know, we ignore Donald Trump's speeches. Yesterday at an event in Wisconsin, Donald Trump talked about how he won Wisconsin, which is obviously a lie and led to the storming of the Capitol. And that didn't make the newspapers, but we do mention that on this podcast.
He also did that little press conference in front of all of those cops wearing their uniforms.
Yeah, it was in Michigan, yeah.
And I just, as a throwaway side thing. I think that police officers who stand with Donald Trump, there's a lot of commentary about how like, oh, they're standing with this guy who has all these felonies. How about this is a guy who had people attack their brothers and sisters in blue? How about that? How about the fact that they didn't care that those other cops' lives were in danger? It doesn't seem like people are standing on their thin blue line very well here, back in the blue very efficiently. Anyway, side thing.
Concur.
Back to Wisconsin. So the two points that I would make is that Joe Biden has to hold his anti-Trump coalition together. and need to continue to win a place like Wisconsin's a tipping point state. Like, he has got to win Wisconsin. The blue wall is the thing again, and that'll take us to Nebraska here in a second. But like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, he has to win those, especially because I think he's going to struggle harder with Georgia and Nevada and maybe even Arizona. But the reason that I care so much is that when people show up, they take the time to get off the couch, to go take time out of their day to vote against somebody, that's an enthusiasm indicator. That is I will take any minute that I've got to go vote against this guy. And you need to, I think with this, the negativity of this rematch and people feeling really like blah about it, to see that kind of enthusiasm to go out and like take a shot at Trump for no reason, that makes me feel good about where people's enthusiasm to vote against him is currently.
I agree with that. I agree that there's an enthusiastic core of people that are excited to vote against Donald Trump.
Yep.
I'm worried that that is not the people that really kind of are going to matter in the end. But I'll take it. I'll take the pony. I'll take it. I want to move on to Nebraska. Donald Trump and Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen were apparently inspired by Charlie Kirk. So boy, we're really in the bad place when Charlie Kirk is dictating policy. But Charlie pointed out that it's not great for MAGA and the coming MAGA autocracy for Nebraska to divide its electoral votes by congressional district. You might know that Nebraska has 5 electoral votes, and that they get 2 for the statewide. They give 2 to the statewide winner and then 1 to each congressional district. The Omaha congressional district held by Don Bacon is very swingy. Joe Biden won it last time. So as a result, now the Nebraska is looking at changing the 1991 law that divided up the electors and having it be winner take all like all the other states. This is important for this reason. You mentioned the big blue wall there. If Joe Biden of the swing states loses Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, loses the Sun Belt, loses the heavily Hispanic states, but wins the upper Midwest blue wall, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, that takes them to a gentleman's 269 not that nice electoral votes, because that would send the election into the House of Representatives. If Nebraska does separate out its districts and he wins the Don Bacon district, which he should, that would take him to 270 and make him the president of these United States. So significant. There is an offset, though, also, that if Nebraska did this, then our friends in Maine, where there is a Democratic trifecta, where it's the other state, which is the inverse of Nebraska, that has the same law, but there is a rural red district that went for Donald Trump, Maine could change their laws and offset this to make Maine winner take all. Edgar, what do you think about the machinations here? How important is this?
I guess I'm a little surprised it hadn't been done or attempted before. I guess it's just the fact that Nebraska's gotten a little redder while Omaha has become swingier.
The vision of Charlie Kirk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, among the Charlie Kirk things we've seen over the years, this does not really break like the top 10 of like objectionable. I'm kind of like, oh, okay.
Oh my God. Doesn't break the top 10 of this week.
Yeah, exactly.
He was talking about how birth control make women depressed this week. Mm-hmm. I've got that audio queued up for the other podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well,
no, it's the men they're having sex with as on birth control that are making them depressed. Sorry.
Just a joke. I don't know. I meant to look this up this morning and then did not. Like the way the different legislative sessions overlap, like, are we 100% sure that Maine would actually have the ability to respond in time to change their own?
I can field that question. Maine is out of session, but both the governor and the legislature have the right to call special sessions in Maine. So, you know, I don't know if we have any Maine listeners, but an excited core of state senators or legislators in Maine could do this, or the governor.
Yeah. So I guess my basic read is it would just be kind of a bummer, like, good for Charlie for trying to put points on the board for his team in a like sneaky legal way. But I like the silliness of the map. I like the way it lets the wonks and the eggheads on Twitter do fun things with their predictions. I don't know. I don't know what to say about it other than it is bizarre to imagine that flipping Omaha. I mean, I guess it's sort of like Miami-Dade, right, in 2000, but it would be kind of funny if the 2024 election came down to Omaha and their zoo.
Do they have a nice zoo?
They have a really nice zoo.
Great steaks, too. Here's the thing. 5 hours and 10 minutes. That's the time distance between when Charlie Kirk said this on his podcast and the governor of the state put out a statement being like, we should do this. And the story here is about the new wave of MAGA activists to whom Republicans feel enormously beholden and enormously responsive to. And I think that the big story is just like Charlie Kirk, who sits, I mean, look, and I'm not, I think we should all be allowed to be unshaven and unkempt on our political podcasts because, you know, we're not here to be, leave that to Hollywood, okay? We're here for our ideas. You're here to deal with our brains. But still, this kid looks like, you know, he's been run over by a tractor and just sits there spewing nonsense. And he is in the driver's seat on a lot of Republican policy. And so the fact that the Republican governor, who it was nice to have a reason to learn the name of the Nebraska governor, which I didn't know,
Jim Pillen.
Good to know that he's listening to Charlie Kirk and the Charlie Kirk is giving directions. To me, that was the big takeaway.
I agree with Edgar. This is not a particularly alarming suggestion by Charlie Kirk. It's kind of a logic suggestion, but just the fact that there are state governors that are responding to him, you know, that probably doesn't say good things about access to birth control in red states, for example, if governors are going to be just so responsive to Charlie Kirk and his weird.
Can I say one thing,
please,
to push back on that a tiny bit? Cause I do agree that it's completely alarming. You'd want to see like a control group, right? Because I mean, I think part of the reason why there's this quick reaction time is because you see a guy like Pillen who sees a post like that and is like, oh, well, actually, I totally do agree with that on the merits. It is just like free points for our team. It's above board. You know, it'd be political, but it'd be fair for us to do that. I mean, and
so, Trump would love me for
right,
it.
Right. And whereas when Charlie Kirk, for instance, goes on like a weeks long crusade about how we shouldn't any longer celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., that's not exactly the kind of thing that you get like the institutional Republican Party lining up to be like, yeah, let's get rid of that as a national holiday. You know what I mean?
There are a handful of people that were intrigued by that.
Well, I didn't see anything from Pillen about it, at least.
Maybe not Jim Pillen. Okay, well, we're going to test something out here about just how responsive politicians are to podcast hosts. And I think it'd be healthy for Democratic politicians to be less responsive to podcast hosts, but also
Agree. It's
time to fight. So Janet Mills, I'm looking at you right now. You have 5 hours from the posting of this podcast. Let's get this thing happening in Maine. All right. Let's just clean this thing up. We don't have to wait for Nebraska. We can make sure to unify Maine's electoral votes to ensure, do our part to protect us from a Donald Trump autocracy. Janet Mills, we're watching you here at the Next Level Podcast. Do you know who Janet Mills is, Sarah?
I do now.
This podcast is sponsored by ZBiotics. If there's a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after a night of drinking, it's with ZBiotics. For listeners who haven't tried it yet, ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics pre-alcohol drink your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly and you'll feel your best tomorrow. You know who didn't do that? Producer Sebastian. He was letting me know on Monday that he was running a little ragged. He was running a little ragged Monday morning, was trying to shake him down to do a YouTube video. Make sure you're checking out Tim's Takes on YouTube, the Bulwark's YouTube feed. Subscribe. And you know, the response time was okay, but, you know, he was lagging a little bit. And I said, well, have you been, you know, doing what our sponsor suggests? You know, have you been engaging in a ZBiotics probiotic drink before you go out in the evening? And that is, I think, a suggestion that he should be taking into account this weekend, because that's the best way to feel refreshed. Right, Sebastian? So you, Sebastian, and our listeners, go to ZBiotics.com/next level to get 15% off your first order when you use next level at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/next level and use the code next level at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our spring break. All right, we are back. We're going to discuss the descent into fascism. Jonathan Last, who's not here on this podcast this week, which I know people are sad about, we're going to represent him in spirit by discussing his newsletter. His newsletter created quite a stir on the right-wing internet. Luckily, I'm on spring break, so I didn't get to spend that much as much time as I usually do on right-wing Twitter. But I did catch it out of the corner of my eye, a few people that were upset with Jonathan. His take was this: if Trump wins, he'll run for a third term and the Republican Party and the Supreme Court will let him. Subtle. It's a subtle take there. Sarah, you and Jonathan sometimes argue about things. What is your take? Do you think that is true? If Donald Trump becomes the president, that he will run again in 2028 and the Republican Party and the Supreme Court will let him?
No, probably not. Probably not.
Probably not.
Probably not. I mean, the letter of the law on this is pretty clear. I'm interested, actually. Can you, before I tell you what I think, can you tell? I missed the right-wing Twitter reaction to what he said. What was it?
Oh, JVL has TDS. JVL's a grifter. Blah, 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 blah. JVL's brain has been broken by Donald Trump. Blah, 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 blah. This isn't really going to happen. Da, 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 even though that there was an article pushing for this in the American Conservative magazine.
Let me give JVL his due. Because what JVL, where he sort of like, pointed for his shot, right? When he like put his finger up and said, it's going here. What he said was, at some point, there's going to be a movement to eliminate the 22nd Amendment and to say that Donald Trump can be president for infinitum.
And who was right about that?
And he was right about that, right? The American conservative came out with a whole long piece about how Donald Trump should be allowed to do this. Why should we ignore the will of the people? If a president, after a four-year hiatus, you know, has some time out, is so popular and so people are so excited to have them back that they are reelected, why shouldn't they get another consecutive term? So,
really quick, while we are giving his due, other things that he was right about that these butt boys on the internet were not right about include the fact that Donald Trump was going to attempt a coup. That he was going to try to stay in power, even if he loses, that the Republican Party was going to go along with that. That's another thing that he said that the National Review was like, never, no, no, sorry. No, that is actually what ended up happening. And then he said that Donald Trump is going to, that they are not going to convict him. And then that Donald Trump is going to run for president again. And everyone is going to get behind him. And everyone, when he said that, with all the right-wing vloggers at the corner, were like, no, that's not, no, it's over. He's dead. Mitch McConnell said, we're finally rid of the bastard, to Jonathan Martin for his book. And he was right about that. And so, you know, that's just, those are some interesting facts to maybe consider when you look into the crystal ball here.
And this is why, as I fight with JVL, I am mindful that my optimism has been crushed by reality over and over and over again. And so I'm more circumspect before tussling with JVL. Now, I will say, though, JVL often takes these very definitive positions that I think strike just a little. So, for example, I'll just tell you where JVL has been wrong. I love doing this when he's not here.
Right,
we should
too.
Have a whole segment when he's not here.
Same.
Sorry, buddy, you're not here. Let's talk to JVL's always wrong segment.
That's what you get for going on spring break, bro.
Yeah, but he was like, DeSantis is going to drop out before Iowa. You know, he had this whole DeSantis. And I was like, no, he's going to go through Iowa's whole campaign. You know, it's like things like that. Sometimes JVL can just go just a little bit extra. But that's what makes his newsletter exciting. And he's directionally correct about the level of acquiescence. And I thought this newsletter, it was a good trip down memory lane about all of the big moments when Republicans rationalized their way out of accountability for Trump. And so I think that taking his broader point that there's no reason that we should be so certain that the institutional right will not do everything they can to do whatever Donald Trump wants, I think he's right about that. Where I think I'm not sure he's right is the idea that the Supreme Court lets that happen. I mean, he kind of uses as evidence of that, like, he's basically got me convinced that the institutional right, including the political class, will let Trump, will start making this argument. Oh, it was stolen from Trump. He was treated so unfairly. I don't think the Supreme Court upholds it. I still have a decent amount of faith in the Supreme
Court. Brett Kavanaugh, beer.
just not going totally off the rails. Yeah. I don't think so. And
no,
I think
I want to get into Supreme Court disaster porn at the end of this. But I want to engage Egger first on just the principle. Mm-hmm. Andrew Egger, here's my question. What do you think is the percent chance that if Donald Trump wins, that what JVL says is right? That he would run in 2028 and that people would essentially go along with it?
I think the percent chance is very low. I'm not a math guy. I'm going to say
2%?
5 or 10%? 5 or 10% is too high even. I think it's, look.
3%?
So I completely agree with Sarah that, yeah, say 2-3%, something like that.
That's pretty high. Yeah, well, that's too high. That's higher than it's been. I mean, it's higher than it's been historically. Like, since FDR left, it's certainly the highest it's been.
Is this the percent chance that every domino lines up correctly and he is like actually?
Okay, maybe not that every single domino in the newsletter lines up correctly, but that Donald Trump would, through some various level of machinations, be on the ballot in 2028. That he would try to run or that he would, or that the elections, I don't know, who the hell knows?
The difficulty I have with the question is that I struggle to see psychologically why Donald Trump would want to run again if he wins, because first of all, he will be insanely old by then. But so much of his rationale for running in 2024 was the complete inability to get over not being able to be a loser to Biden in 2020, needing to relitigate that, needing to stay out of jail. He doesn't really have like a substantial political project that he's like dying to, like, you know, go to his last breath bringing about for America, it seems.
You don't think that the Democrat, whoever that would be, that would emerge in 2027 or 2028 would run on a platform of wanting to jail Donald Trump? Because I do.
I guess that's possible. Yeah, I don't know. You think so?
Well, for starters, I think that he will have won and then pardoned himself.
Right.
And then I think it's pretty safe. We can all agree on this. It's pretty safe to assume that he'll probably do some more crimes between 2025 and 2028,
okay,
when he's the president.
Yeah,
I think that's pretty clear that he'll probably do some more crimes. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe he'll just decide to golf and like be so happy that he won that he'll just golf and like whatever, just hang out. But I think he'll probably not. Probably he'll do more crimes. And so
the one other psychological point that I want to make, though, is less about Trump and more about the base, which is that, and I was you know, covering campaigns full time through the whole, basically the whole primary cycle as it existed, such as it was before I came over here. And very routinely, I mean, I think it's easy to undercount the amount of support that Trump got in this election in particular from Republican voters who had kind of imbibed his idea that A, his first term was kind of, it was kind of mean what they did to him, you know, throughout all that. He didn't get as much stuff off the ground as he should have. But B, he was really robbed in 2020 because he didn't lose that election, they all think. And so a lot of voters found that a very persuasive reason not to even really think about other alternatives in the primary, you know, who would potentially perhaps have been Ron DeSantis people or you know, whoever else, Vivek Ramaswamy people. They're like, well, no, look, like, this is still Trump's year. He needs his second term. He deserves his second term. But these are still people who are thinking in terms of presidents have two terms, right?
I think that's all fair. I want to throw this out. I think that's all fair. I think it's all fair and practical and wise even. I'll say this though. You forget how long all this stuff is. And so this is my JVL. This is my most full-throated defense of JVL, who I think obviously was being a little definitive. But my point is the questions, the gray area here when it comes to Donald Trump. Just consider this. If Andrew Egger and I were on a podcast and Sarah Longwell in April 3rd of 2016, and we said, and I said to you, what is the percent chance that Donald Trump wins this election in 2016, becomes the president, loses in 2020, tries to stay in power, and a mob of people storm the Capitol attempting to assassinate his vice president? I mean, I would know what I would have said then. 0%. 0%. 1%. 2%.
All of that. And then the Republican Party wants him back. Like, we would have been like, absolutely
insane.
Not.
Insane. And I had TDS.
Yeah.
In April of 2016, I was like the spokesperson for the Republicans Against Trump movement, literally. And so, and I would have said 0%. So anyway, this is not to say that what everything the JVL says is going to turn out. But when you have someone such as Donald Trump, who has autocratic aspirations, who has just the worst imaginable character, who is going to be fighting jail, I think, for the rest of his days, no matter what happens, who the fuck knows what he'll do? And he gets older and more deranged and all this. Who the fuck knows what he's going to do? And then there's always the JVL point about, and then I think the Supreme Court would do the right thing probably too. I'm with Sarah on this. But then what? Then it's like, okay, the marshal of the Supreme Court's going to arrest Donald Trump. Now we get back into that territory, right? This is all fantasy porn. It's fantasy porn because we're in a situation where, like, all of that is on the table. None of that has ever been on the table before. None of that has been on the table since the Civil War, with the FDR situation accepted. Like, none of that has been on the table, and it's all on the table. So, like, you know, the people who are just like, absolutely not, JVL, you've had your brain broken. Well, they've been wrong for 9 years, and we're in unprecedented times. So that's my defense of JVL. I don't know, Sarah, if you had any.
Yeah. You know, well, I will just say that what was the famous line about 9/11? It was, we suffered from a failure to imagine. And like, at this point, we are not doing our jobs. We're not, I mean, like, if you don't sit and think about the potential problems that could arise, like, you're ignoring everything that we've been faced with over the last 7 years that, yes, of course, we thought couldn't happen because of institutions and norms. And boy, this stuff just doesn't happen. So it can't happen. And we should not suffer from a failure to imagine now. And I think it's good, even if JVL, I think, has, you know, some sort of misses at the margins with how extreme things is, like, again, directionally correct in the idea that we should at no point discount what Donald Trump will want to do and what the Republican Party will let him do.
Andrew, any final thoughts on that before we get really into the bad place?
No, I mean, I think we wrote in Morning Shots a couple days ago, maybe yesterday, about there was a piece up at the Bulwark about the possibility of this upcoming election, Trump trying to steal it again, essentially through essentially just having state legislatures assume control over the appointment of electors rather than giving them to the whoever wins the popular vote in those states, which, you know, they could do under the apparatus of the Constitution. There's nothing preventing that from happening. And I think, like, it is true. Like I already said why I think all these things are extremely unlikely. But like you say, one of the annoying things about the present moment is that you really have to think about things in terms of what's actually excluded by you know, the real curves. And I do think, you know, the Supreme Court, the text of that amendment, as you say, if the words on the page mean anything, it's excluded. But I guess that's a...
Are you ready for this idea? How about this? How about Donald Trump says that he only will endorse a candidate in 2028 who agrees to make him vice president? Because the vice president, it's not quite as clear. I've had an extended side chain with some legal experts and some Obama people who believe that, like, it's really not so clear that Joe Biden couldn't name Barack Obama vice president. Like, it's pretty clear. Like, the intent is pretty clear, but it's not. It's sort of closer to the 14th Amendment situation than the 22nd Amendment situation. So, you know, anyway, it's what Putin did.
My overwhelming feeling about all this is, like, Let's just get through this election. Like, let's get through 2024.
Okay.
Then we'll deal with what comes
I'd like to beat him. All right. So we're slowly descending. Okay, go ahead.
And I would like to see some humility from the National Review crowd, the crowd that suggests that none of these things could ever happen because they've been wrong literally all the time.
For a decade. Yeah, if you've been wrong for an entire decade about what the Republican Party is going to do, then just, like, leave a little bit of openness to the fact that maybe you're wrong again. I want to talk about Gaza. The Israeli government did an oopsie and the IDF killed seven people that were part of the World Central Kitchen, the Jose Andres operation. Three Britons, a Palestinian, a U.S.-Canadian dual citizen, a Pole, and an Australian. I feel like this bears mentioning. So they were in a World Health Kitchen vehicle that was hit by a missile. Then they left the vehicle, got into another car, which was hit by another missile. And then the third car in the convoy approached to pick up the occupants of the second car, and that was hit by a third missile. The strike killed all of the workers in that convoy.
I think you get to do oops on one vehicle. I think on three, I'm not sure you get.
Yeah, I'm not a military expert, so this podcast is not going to be about, like, the Israeli strategy here and what exactly to do, how to implement a strategy. I do think that what I want to get to here is the political implications. And when you have a situation where you fire three missiles at people that are providing food, volunteer service to in an area that is at risk of famine, you know, that's something that you got to answer for, and that is going to cause downstream effects. One of those downstream effects, statement put out by the White House, Joe Biden said he was outraged and heartbroken by the killings, demands a swift investigation into them that would bring accountability, and the findings of that investigation must be made public. This is not a standalone incident, he says, et cetera, et cetera. Look, I think that there was a period of time when I want to bring this up is, I think that maybe probably the last time we discussed this issue on this podcast, there was a sense that, like, this is bad. The situation is bad for Biden. It's bad for Israel. Obviously, the Hamas actions are bad. It's just bad all around. But, you know, maybe by November, by the fall, this will not so much be a front of mind issue anymore. It will be a back burner issue. I don't really feel that way anymore. And it doesn't seem like there is a plan out of this. And I think that Joe Biden is in a pretty tough spot where he's now got, I think it's going to be very hard to appease the people that are calling him Genocide Joe and the activists with statements such as this. And every statement such as this creates more distance from people that are wanting him to be stalwart with Israel. And even though Joe Biden has hit the sweet spot on this issue for Tim Miller, I think that he's in the sour spot politically on it. So I don't know. I open it up to either of you.
Well, I'll say this. I don't know if you caught the focus group podcast that I did with one Andrew Egger.
I did. It was a great episode. People should check it. I know it was another depressing episode because just like the degree of addiction to TikTok and how people are like mindlessly repeating TikTok talking points. I mean, like any activist organization in the world would dream of having their users and their followers repeat their talking points just as mindlessly as the TikTok users repeated the TikTok talking points. It was like shocking.
And they have such a bipartisan devotion.
They were,
right?
Like, like liberal TikTok users were like, what about the small business owners? I was like, what?
The young conservatives are like, you know, they make their free speech. This is, you know, how can you let in the libs? Yeah. And everybody's in for the conspiracy theories. So anyway. Just different ones. But that's, we were focused on TikTok for the episode. And Andrew was awesome on the episode. His analysis was great. But what we didn't play as much of, there was a few snippets, but was super clear in the group of young progressives. They had all voted for Biden in 2020, the people. And they were, only about half the group was willing to say they were voting for Biden this time around. They weren't voting for Trump. And it wasn't because he was going to ban TikTok. It was because of Gaza. And they were getting a lot of their Gaza information from TikTok. And there was this sense among, when they had their, like, because for a lot of it, it's about like, well, this is information they don't want us to have. They were like, well, you know, they don't want us to know about what's happening in Gaza. And TikTok is where I get my information about Gaza. And I've obviously understood for a while about the fact that this situation presents a real challenge for Joe Biden. But I had been sort of sanguine, as you had, about the idea that, like, this is going to shift. Like, it's not going to stay like this. And I don't think it's too late now for it to shift. But I do think that, like, look, I have such a pedestrian understanding of the Israel-Gaza thing. So I'm not an expert. I want Joe Biden to do the right thing, not just the political thing when it comes to the situation in Israel and Gaza. That being said, I think it is a political catastrophe for him if it continues direct like this way. I also feel less certain than I might have 3 months ago that we're still doing the right thing. It's not just that this can't go on for political reasons. It's that, like, at some point, the loss of life overall becomes intolerable, right? The situation becomes overall intolerable, which is not to say that the Israelis were not absolutely justified in a major response after October 7th and aren't still completely justified in figuring out how to obliterate Hamas. But, like, we are in a situation now where you're seeing aid workers get murdered. And I think not just for these voters that I'm listening to, but for me, when you see it, I start to be like, man, people who like me, who I think are pretty, I'm pretty like on a gut level pro-Israel and certainly anti-Hamas terrorist. But I'm like, man, Joe, I don't know. I don't know how long you can, we can just stand by while this is happening, because I think we can't.
Yeah, and the famine side of it, and this is why it ties to the World Central Kitchen. I mean, like, we are really at serious danger of not just now people dying in Gaza because of missiles, but dying because of starvation. And so if we're killing the aid workers that are just bringing food,
right?
Like, you know, again, that helps. That is why this is so important as both a political issue and a facts on the ground issue, as you know, exacerbating the problem. Anyway, Andrew.
Much like Sarah, I mean, this is not my bailiwick at all, foreign policy stuff. I mean, it seems to me that there was kind of like a normie case that was intelligible to the average voter in the wake of October 7, why Israel needed to go in and you know, prevent something like that from happening again in a war-torn region where they have tons of enemies. You know, they needed to show strength, and they needed to, you know, root out Hamas, and they needed to do all of these things. There is still an intelligible case for why Israel continues to need to prosecute their war, but it is not that like gut level thing that's just kind of like obvious to people. I mean, it's you essentially have to get into all of the just war theory. You have to get into the acceptable risk. You have to say, okay, Hamas started this war. Israel has a right to prosecute its military objective, which is rooting out Hamas, and Hamas is calculating their strategy is to hide in the civilian population and to hide in among aid workers and among hospitals and all of these things and ratchet up that international pressure in order to get everybody to hate Israel. And you can't blame Israel for that. I mean, this is the intellectual case. And I don't know. I mean, like, these are kind of the precepts of who's at fault in war that underpin a lot of our international law. And so it's hard for me as a guy, just a layperson, to be like, well, you know, they can't do that. But at the same time, I mean, you cannot at all be surprised when the average person who looks at this stuff, I mean, they look at the facts on the ground in Gaza right now. They see, you know, not only that, you know, 2/3 of the strip has been bombed into rubble already with you know, basically a million refugees clustered into Rafah and Netanyahu now continuing to say they're planning to go in and take care of Rafah too, and the possibility of mass starvation and the blockades of aid getting in. And now look at a flashpoint story like this, where you have this group, this World Central Kitchen convoy that was coordinating with the IDF that was saying, okay, here's where we're gonna be, and don't bomb us. I mean, that's why they're doing that. They're doing that specifically, right, to say, this is what we're doing, this is our itinerary. We're in clearly marked vehicles. So, I mean, again, like from a normie point of view, even if it were true, which it did not end up being true, that there was some Hamas operative like who had gotten in the car with them that the IDF really wanted to take care of, how they make the moral case that, okay, sorry, you had a Hamas operative with you, so we need to bomb you, when these are the only people who have even one finger and one leak in the dike of mass starvation in that region, how you sell that to the country when you're buying the bombs. I mean, like, it's.
Can I just say, like, what I want to see from Joe Biden, right? Okay, they put out a statement, sure, but like, Joe Biden can't be a bystander, right? In this conflict, I think it is unfair to blame Joe Biden. I think it's unfair to call him genocide Joe. He's not committing genocide. He didn't start this war, and you know, and we have a responsibility to other democracies, but also, if we are going to help provide funds or munitions, we are part of this and we have power in the situation. And I think that we should exercise that power toward an end that is, because look, here's what Hamas needs to do. They need to release the rest of the Israeli hostages. Like, the problem is that, you know, everybody who calls for ceasefires and everything just sort of like forgets the idea that Hamas took hostages that they have continued to rape and torture and in some cases kill. And so like, they need to release all the hostages. But like, where are we in a high profile way, like getting to that end? Like, I think we should, like, that's about people coming to the table. That's about people negotiating. And I think we've got to figure out Joe Biden's got to figure out, and the administration, how to take a more high profile role in looking like he is trying to resolve this as opposed to just letting it go on indefinitely.
Yeah, Tony Blinken's been pretty good on that, but it's been a lot of behind the scenes. I mean, he's done some public stuff, but we could use more Tony.
Well, and can I say one thing about that? I mean, please. Because I've been at the White House press briefing where they've gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth on this, and they, you know, they're trying to lead with it. They're trying to say, you know, look, we are working very hard to get to temporary ceasefire that would hopefully roll over into permanent ceasefire. And it is true that the biggest concrete obstacle to that is Hamas continuing to refuse to release these hostages, and Biden and his administration have taken what seems like a pretty righteous line in saying, like, okay, until that happens, how are you going to expect us to really put pressure on Israel to stop doing this? But at a certain point, I mean, like, you kind of have to contemplate the question of, does the Hamas strategy end up working? I mean, like, is it actually true that their calculation is correct, that there is an amount of collateral damage that's just unacceptable to even Biden in the White House, even people who are staunch pro-Israel allies, just because the situation becomes so grim and grisly that at a certain point you have to essentially negotiate with terrorists. And I mean, I'm very happy that I am not at the table myself. I mean, it's such a grisly, horrible situation for so many reasons.
Yeah. One more thing I just want to mention on the politics of this. And this is just, again, such a tragedy. I hope that there's no sense of glibness in mentioning and saying it was an oops, because it was just a tragic, horrific oops that is going to, I think, reverberate. And I was just pulling this up. The 60 Minutes report on Abu Ghraib came out April of 2004. So this time, the 2004 election, obviously Bush ends up still winning. But this feels like the kind of thing that can reverberate as that did, right? Like, you had like the general disaster, the general humanitarian disaster obviously has landed with certain folks, particularly those on the activist progressive left, particularly younger folks. But, you know, broadening out to get people that have been more directionally sympathetic to Israel to start to have concerns, like, this is the kind of thing that can do it, in the same way that Abu Ghraib did for Iraq. And I think that I mention this always when this stuff comes up, but it's not just kids, right? It's like basically anybody younger than Sarah, sorry, Sarah, like, doesn't remember U.S. military successes. Like, doesn't. Like, just we don't have any, right? And so when you're coming, like, I have a lot of people that sometimes email me that are more pro-Israel when I express these concerns, that are like, well, you know, did we have a plan for Germany post-World War II? Like, no, we did what we had to do to win the war, and then you deal with it. And it's like, okay, yeah, but I a huge, it's not just TikTok kids. Like, basically everybody up till middle age is like, I'm sorry, like, I don't have a lot of the trust that we'll take care of this, that we're going to do, that the military leadership is going to do the right thing. Like that trust has withered over the past couple decades. And so when Israel and Joe Biden working with Israel cannot enunciate okay, here is the plan, right, for how we're going to stop the tragedy and get to some sort of temporary solution or semi-permanent solution, then people start to like look at the tragedy and say, I'm just not sure this is going to be worth it anymore. And so I think that adds to the political risk here. So anywho, that is The Next Level for this week. Cool. JVL will be back next week, and so it'll be so much more uplifting. We'll be so much happier with JVL around. He's just a ray of sunshine, as you guys all know. Andrew Egger, make sure you're checking out his Morning Shots newsletter. It is wonderful. Listen to him and Sarah on the Focus Group podcast. We also have another announcement. If you haven't had enough of this uplifting episode with me and Sarah, we are back together, no Egger, on the Secret podcast on Friday, that usually it's Sarah and JVL. So if you guys are not a Board Plus member, and you want to hear me and Sarah talk about women's basketball and other more fun stuff, let's do it. This is your moment. Become a Board Plus member. We're back on Friday on the Secret Pod. And, you know, we're going to keep it light and breezy. Catch me tomorrow on the Board Pod. Peace, y'all.